died, Father, is nothing left.
Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that? Become yourself. Name God and the devil don't matter. I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact strength. And that is why you are here.
Welcome to everyone tuning in today. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and the website is redicecreations.com. Today we're talking with Robert G. Johnson and Janie Westin about their book, The Last Kings of Norse America, Runestone Keys to a Lost Empire. This highlights a different side of the story behind the Kensington Runestone that we recently talked about on the program. That's what we do on this program. We find contradictory and sometimes opposing opinions within the alternative so that you, as the audience, can come to your own conclusions about the material for yourself. We do not believe in censoring it beforehand, because we happen to favor one side or the other. We believe in your ability to be able to deduct and reason for yourself so that you can make up your own mind. Robert G. Johnson received his PhD in physics from Iowa State University after a puzzle-solving career in industrial research at Honeywell. He joined the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Minnesota to work on the mystery of past climate variations. Initially a professional calligrapher, Janie Westin pursued paleographic studies of medieval manuscripts, stone inscriptions, the structure of letter forms, and the tools and material of the trade. Westin studied calligraphy at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design and has a Bachelor's of Arts degree in Japanese from the University of Minnesota. Her studio, Paper and Stone, is located in Edina, Minnesota. So stay with us today as we begin to unravel this hidden history of a Norse expedition to North America, documented by a 1354 royal proclamation. Both the Kensington Runestone, found in 1898 on a settler's farm in Minnesota, and the Spirit Pond Runestone, found 73 years later on coastal Maine, were memorials to the men lost during this expedition that was intended to basically reestablish connections with a trading outpost that was been going between Greenland and Vinland, today Newfoundland on the North American continent. The trip was led by Håkon VI, son of Magnus, king of Sweden and Norway. And if true, this is another one of these Time to Rewrite the History Books programs, so stay with us for much more. Robert G. Johnson and Janie Westin is with us. Welcome to both of you to the program. We are very glad to have you with us. It's going to be interesting. It's a topic close to my heart, obviously, old Scandinavian history, and of course how that's extended into other parts of the world is very fascinating to me. I've been doing some reading on this for many years now. So first of all, we'll say hi to Robert. Thanks for coming on. Good to have you with us.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. And hi to Janie as well for joining us. Hi, Janie.
Hello.
It's really nice to talk about this, and it's interesting. I said that to you earlier, Janie, that we need to bring on Americans to talk about Norse history, because we've tried with some people over here and get them on, and it's more difficult for some reason. But I think also, what considering the topic that we're going to get into, this is it has a different twist to it, because it merges Scandinavian history with the American one. And I just, before we kind of dive into the meat of the book, of course, that we're going to talk about, I wanted to ask you first, Robert, when this journey began for you, when you first got into this this field.
Well, as Janie said, this was a joint effort from the very beginning, because both she and I were involved. We were asked to take part in this examination with a microscope of the surface of the Kensington Runestone back in 2001. So we were both in on it from the beginning, and we've been in on it right up to the present time.
What's your background, Robert, and Janie as well, in terms of the request to have you guys work on the Kensington Runestone?
Well, I'll let Janie speak for herself there, but I'm trained as a physicist, and I spent a career and 23 years of retirement solving problems. And this was another problem of a very fascinating nature because of the controversy that has surrounded the Kensington Stone for the last 100-odd years, and likewise surrounded the Spirit Pond Runestone since 1971.
How about you, Janie? You have a background in medieval manuscripts and calligraphy and things like that as well, right?
Yes. When I was at the University of Minnesota studying Japanese, which is what I majored in, Japanese language, I took a serious calligraphy class, got very involved with the calligraphy, and knew that was what my real interest was. And as a result, ended up doing quite a bit of very in-depth study of medieval, especially the mid to later medieval time period, European manuscripts, looking at the, not just the letter forms, but the illustrations, learning about abbreviation, all sorts of aspects of that. And as a calligrapher, I also started carving letters in stone, and that led to being the bulk of the work that I do now. And so it's the Kensington Runestone and the Spirit Pond Inscription Stone. It was a natural for me to be interested in what they are, what they say, trying to come up with an accurate full translation of what the Spirit Pond Stone, what the inscription stone says on it, which no one had successfully done before my dad and I tackled that one. We also have a little bit different perspective on the Kensington Runestone and what its inscription says, because if you look at where the medieval manuscript forms of abbreviation are and how they were used at that time period, you can see how some forms of abbreviation that were common in manuscripts of the 1300s, how they were borrowed and used. One type of abbreviation used for the Kensington Runestone and another one used for the Spirit Pond Inscription Stone. So they're fascinating, both very, very fascinating artifacts.
Indeed, we've talked before on the program about the Kensington Runestone, and we're going to get into obviously, some of the differences here and interpretation and translations and everything else. But when you guys first went into it, when you first, started looking at this, I can ask this to you, Janie. Did you think that it was a fake at the time, as so many has claimed? Was this the perception, if you will, that you were going into it with?
Well, in 2001, I was kind of sitting on the fence. I hadn't read up an awful lot on the background of it, enough to know that there were a number of experts that over the past had felt that for one reason or another that it was a hoax produced by somebody. And I thought, well, gee, I'd sure like to take a look at this as a letter carver, and make my own opinion on this, because the only thing that had been said as far as how it was carved, up to that point that I had read was an opinion from two stone sculptors, back in the 1950s that had been asked to look at it, and they concluded that the carver had to have been, left-handed or right-handed, I can't remember which it was. And I knew as a letter carver, which is very different from being a sculptor and solely a sculptor, that as a letter carver, it doesn't matter whether you're right or left-handed. You wouldn't be able to tell by looking at the inscription, because a carver might carve it, looking at the letters or the runes as they were being carved, right side up, or they may turn it around and carve it looking at it in what might be considered an upside down way, mm-hmm. too. So right or left hand, to me it was just it just didn't make sense to be able to draw that conclusion. Because as a letter carver, sometimes I need to turn something upside down to be able to carve on it. It's just a practicality what you're carving and the situation where you are located where you're carving it. So other than that one opinion having been given in the past, I wanted to and was just delighted that that my dad and I were asked to be able to look at the Kensington Moonstone. I wanted to look at it from my own perspective, and we had a good microscope, very good light, a couple nice big burly guys who could turn it and move it in any position we wanted, and we had 3.5 hours to look at it. And after that examination, my conclusion was, and my dad concurred, is that it was no hoax. By comparing the aging on different areas of the surface of the Kensington Runestone, you, especially looking at them under a microscope, you could do a logical, very logical comparison of the weathering of different surfaces and determine that the farmer that found it, Olaf Ullmann, in 1898, he could not have been the person that made this. And it had to have been carved quite some time prior to that, meaning a number of hundreds of years, and 1362, which is the date on the Kensington Runestone, fit what I thought as a stone carver would be a decent logical amount of aging comparison. So
indeed,
it was pretty eye opening and quite interesting to see.
How shortly after that did you guys start looking at the language itself on the stone, what it actually said, and do the translation? Because there are different versions of the translations, right? It's not it's not unanimous of what it says, right?
Yes, that's true.
You know, it wasn't until 2, 3, or 4 years later that we really got into the translation. After our examination at Alexandria of the Kensington Stone, we did a lot of field work. We went out and looked at the site where the Kensington Rune Stone was found, and we did a little detective work there, and we finally successfully identified the island that was named in the Kensington Runestone inscription. This had never been properly identified before. People thought it was the hill on which the stone was found, and that was not correct because you couldn't make an island out of a hill without flooding the whole half the state of Minnesota. So we identified the island as a little knoll about a rifle shot to the north of the hill. And the little knoll had a lot of rocks on it, and it was surrounded by low-lying land when the settlers first came in the 1800s and settled that country. But it had been a lake surrounding the island in the 1362 time, hundreds of years earlier. But as you may know, shallow lakes simply disappear. They get filled with cattail debris and mud, and pretty soon they're a swamp, and if you wait long enough, you can plow it up and plant corn there. And that's exactly what had happened to the old lake that surrounded this island that was mentioned in the inscription. And now the consequence of that was that the island in the inscription, when it was first found, when the inscription was first translated back in about 1900 or so, that island was unknown, and it was a problem for the interpretation of the inscription, and it reinforced the skeptics who believed that the stone was not genuine, because if you couldn't find an island, then what in the heck is this guy talking about? It must be a hoax.
Yeah.
So that's a key thing that we discovered in the first year, actually, in year 2001.
So there's a lot of, obviously, as you said, groundwork here where you've been looking at maps and trying to, well, basically reconstruct a story that you guys are following in the book in a very, very interesting way. It's laid out that you can follow it as a novel almost in some cases in the book, but it's obviously a detailed story, a detective story almost of what happened. I kind of want to introduce this story a little bit to our audience that haven't heard about this before. So why don't we go back in the timeline, guys, and try to detail a little bit of the history of how this began, because the stone is there at 1362, but this is from a more recent excursion. We've talked about Vinland before, the area in Newfoundland where most likely Scandinavians via Greenland actually went to. But there's a whole surrounding story here. So why don't we kind of get into it, guys, and whoever wants to kick this off can just go ahead and do so.
Well, the thing that if you would allow me to go far enough back in time, we should really go back to the time that America was first seen by the Norsemen. Leif Erikson, a famous Norseman, he settled for a winter or two in Newfoundland, as you hinted just a minute ago. And after Leif Erikson, just a few years later, there was a Norseman by the name of Carl Sefni. Thorfinn Carl Sefni was his full name. He came from Iceland, and he was a guest of Leif Erikson's, and the next year he sailed out to settle himself somewhere in New England, we think. And to make the story not too long, he spent a nice winter in New England and would have liked to settle there after he did some very successful trading for furs with the Indians. But the trading degenerated into a little hostile encounter, and an Indian and a couple of Norsemen were killed. So Carl Sefni decided it was a little too dangerous to settle there, so he took his furs and went back to Greenland and then sailed back to Norway and sold his goods, they say in the sagas, which included the furs, and made himself a wealthy man. And he then went back to Iceland and became a famous Icelander.
And I've got to put in 2 cents here. He wasn't alone. His wife, Gudrid, his young, very headstrong, strong woman, Gudrid, went with him. And it is noted in the sagas about Carl Stephanie as well as Gudrid making the trip.
They had a son who was born, as a matter of fact, born in the camp, Leif Erikson's camp at Newfoundland there, the first winter they were there.
Their son, Snorri.
Yeah.
That's right.
But the point I was really trying to lead up to a little bit slowly, perhaps, is that the fur trade really began with Carl Stephanie. He became a wealthy man because of it, and the Norsemen weren't dumb. They realized that this is the way to make a good living by trading for furs with the Indians. Consequently, they developed this trade over the next 200 or more years, and the trade became so economically successful as far as the Norsemen were concerned, and as far as the Norwegian merchants were concerned, the Greenland merchants who sold the furs to the Norwegian merchants, and the king taxed these furs, and it was a great income for the king, because Norway wasn't a very rich country, actually. So that's what developed after the discovery of America up until this expedition was sent out by King Magnus Erikson of Norway to try to restore the fur trade, which had died when the Greenland merchants who carried it out abandoned their homes because the climate got too cold for them to feed their animals, and they had to leave.
And that was in the mid-1300s, when earlier 1300s, when the climate really started to take this nasty, cold, mini ice age or little ice age started about that period.
That's right. This was the incentive for the Greenlanders. They had very short summers at that point, and they, on top of that, with the taxes from the king in Norway, as far as I understood the situation, they decided to leave pretty much. A lot of people emigrated out from Greenland and decided to go to Vinland, Vineland. But why don't we talk a little bit about the perception here that we hear from the mainstream, which is that Vinland only was a successful camp pretty much for what, one or two seasons or something like that, and then they decided to go back again, and that was it. It just fell apart. But how do you guys see this? What actually happened there?
Well, I think the history is fairly clear as far as Leif Erikson is concerned. He went back to Greenland, and his father died, so he inherited his father's lands on Greenland, and he didn't have any motive for settling anymore as a settler in Newfoundland. That was the story that we deduce, or at least we think we know from the sagas.
And what happened to the... Yeah, go ahead, Robert. I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead.
Well, let's see. Did that answer your question, or...?
Yeah, I'm trying to get a little bit more to basically Vinland being used as a gateway, that this was just a temporary location, and obviously, continue the story here, basically, that the Norsemen moved further inland, basically, and get that going. So what we hear today from the official record is that Vinland was just, it was abandoned, and they left it. But the idea that you're presenting is that, well, they did leave it, but that's because they went further inland. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a stopping off point as they went further into the interior of the continent.
Well,
trade.
Let me just say one solid fact. Some of what we say is a little bit speculative, but this is a fact. And that fact is that the fur trade that developed was so important to Norway, that Norway annexed Greenland formally about the year 1261. Now, this is over 200 years after Leif Erikson came. So, and the records of the fur trade in the Norwegian port describe, or they name these animals that supplied the furs, and they're animals that were not living on Greenland. So although they called it the Greenland trade, the trade actually was obtained, or the animals that supplied the furs were obtained from the mainland part of the continent. So from that fact, we deduce that the Norsemen on Greenland must have had a little population explosion there, as populations do. There's a very limited area on Greenland for farming, and it was all taken up within 5 or 10 years after the settlement started. So the young fellas on Greenland who didn't inherit land, who didn't ply a trade on Greenland, if they're going to have an independent life, they have to do something else. And the something else was to go to the continent and be a fur trader. And that's what they did, and we find the evidence for that scattered all over the continent, as we've learned in the last 10 years in doing our research.
Absolutely. It's very interesting. And as you say, Robert, the fur was not something that you could find elsewhere. There's indications here, obviously, that some of this ended up in Norway, and there's even I think there's even records, right, of the king taxing some of these incoming products, if you will, and this is something you couldn't get in Scandinavia, or even going further, you know, into Russia at the time. Correct?
That's correct. That's what we are told by the people who have looked into the matter, and they're pretty authoritative on that, and it makes a lot of sense.
Well, and also there was no competition if they went west to Greenland and points beyond for the trade, for the furs. If they went to the east into what is now current-day Russia, there was competition from the Slavs, the Slavic-speaking people that lived in that area, and that was always a problem. So going to the west, which if you get out a globe and look at it, going west into Hudson Bay and to point south of there, it's really no further than the Vikings, earlier north had done for their trade routes going all the way to the Middle East. They went all the way to,
Constantinople.
Constantinople and beyond. Trading silver that came out of silver mines run by the Caliphate in the Caspian Sea area and Black Sea. They went very, very long distances, and it really wasn't much different than what they were doing at an earlier time period going east, but going west, they didn't have other people to compete with, as long as the Native American people they were trading with were happy with what the goods were that they acquired in trade. And the sagas describe when Thorfinn, Karlsefni, and Gudrid first came to Finland, that the Indians that they first traded with were very happy to have what was described as just a square of red cloth. They thought that was just the most wonderful thing to have. and they traded furs for that. Not that cloth was a cheap commodity, because it was a lot of work for the women on Iceland and Greenland to produce that cloth, which would have been a dyed, hand-spun, hand-woven woolen cloth, or perhaps flax, but most likely wool.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of work, but the furs were much more valuable to the North than that cloth was.
So it was beneficial to both, and there was seems to be a pretty good relations between the natives in America and the incoming Norsemen, right?
Yeah, you can imagine easily how this could have developed, because if you start just as a trader, then both parties benefit. The Indians benefit, and it wasn't just cloth. They traded knives and probably metal arrowheads, too, for all we know. It's a situation where as long as you're a trader and everybody benefits, there's everything is peaceful. Now, we know from our later research that they didn't just travel and trade, that they also settled there and lived in colonies of Norsemen along the St. Lawrence River, for example, and out along the Whetstone River in eastern South Dakota. But they were still traders. They weren't, for a while, they were not competing with the Indians, and so they were able to live as isolated farmers, presumably. We think they probably had cattle and horses. There's an indirect evidence for that.
And sheep.
And perhaps sheep, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked until the trade died. About later in the late 1300s and early 1400s, when the climate became cold on Greenland and the trade no longer occurred, then some of the tribes became hostile, and at least in the Dakota area and western Minnesota, those Norsemen who had lived on isolated farmsteads were forced. We don't know the mechanism, but the hostilities forced them to abandon their farms and take up a tribal lifestyle. They probably joined a friendly tribe of Indians just to survive. And we know that situation propagated forward in time to the Mandan tribe of white Indians that Pierre Vendre discovered back in about 1738, I think, along the Missouri River in North Dakota. They were a tribe of white Indians, and that's what the other Indians called them. And they weren't entirely white, but they were a mixture with a generous dollop of blue-eyed people with blonde hair amongst the other darker complexion Indians.
Interesting. So there was intermarriage, obviously, and the Norsemen, kind of merged in with one of the local tribes and maybe even created one of their own there. That's very interesting. We haven't heard too much about that before. Well, I wanted to ask you guys, obviously, about some of the translations and everything and how this story developed and what happened. Because as you said, Robert, the trade was cut probably due to, climate reasons and was much colder and everything else. But then later here in the story, then Norway and the king, I think, of both Norway and Sweden at the time, wants to try to reestablish the trade route here. So tell us what happened there.
Well, Janie, you want to kick off on that?
Okay. Yeah. Well, King Magnus of Sweden and Norway was having some financial difficulties, and ever since he became king, the royal coffers were pretty pretty bare, and because of a lot of mismanagement of the treasury, he decided that he would sponsor a crusade, as it was dubbed, to the eastern end of the Baltic to try and, of course, Christianize the Slavic-speaking people in that area, but also to force open trade route again back to the east. And that did not go well. He borrowed money from the Pope, basically taking tithe money and using it for financing the crusade. Well, when the plague hit, the crusade failed miserably. Another one, you just suddenly did not have the manpower to be able to do it.
Right.
And Pope did not get his funds paid back and excommunicated the king, which nowadays to a modern-day person, being excommunicated maybe doesn't sound so bad. Say, well, okay, I'm out of the church. I'll just go join another church. Well, it didn't work that way back then. Back then, they were... It was politically political suicide. It was your soul would be damned in hell forevermore. And if you've ever seen any of the medieval manuscript images of what hell was like, it looked pretty bad. And so King Magnus was not in good regard with the Pope. So he did decide, though, that, well, if I can't go east, I will go west and get the fur trade reestablished in that direction, meaning from going from Iceland to Greenland. And Greenland also meant points beyond Greenland. So he had his scribe write up a proclamation in 1354, and we refer to it as the Proclamation of 1354 in the book. And the proclamation is that he will send his second son, King Håkon the Sixth, who was not quite old enough. Not quite of age yet at that point, to be a king yet. He was 14 at the time. But anyways, he, in the proclamation, directed that Håkon would go with the expedition to get to go to Greenland, as it was termed, and that Paul Knutsen, who was a law speaker, Norwegian law speaker, he would be the commander of the expedition. And it's basically a directive that you're going to go to Greenland and get those Greenlanders reestablished as Christians.
Because they diverted away from that point, and they lost contact with Norway even, right? So.
Yes, they had not. The king had not heard from anyone on Greenland for a number of years by that point.
Right.
So he thought, well, gee, let's get the trade going. That was a real good thing to do.
Jenny, could I take it up?
Sure.
Back off just a little bit there. In the proclamation of 1354. It doesn't specifically name Håkon, Håkon the Sixth. We didn't know it was Håkon the Sixth until we obtained the inscription on the Spirit Pond runestone, where Håkon is mentioned there as bearded chief man Håkon. And we immediately jumped to what we think is the correct conclusion, that the unnamed that the king was addressing, was talking to in the 1354 proclamation, that unnamed you was actually his second son, Håkon the Sixth. And that fits very well into the prior history and the subsequent history of the expedition. So we speak of it as an accomplished fact, and we think there's nothing surer than that. So that's how Håkon got into the expedition, and it's kind of a complicated story, as you know, if you've read the history part of the book. Let me just recap that a little bit. The king didn't get along very well with his supporters, who are the nobles, the noblemen in both Norway and Sweden. So he was forced into a delayed abdication. And the terms of the abdication were that when Håkon became age 15, he would be empowered as king of Norway. And his brother, Yuri XII, when King Magnus died, would become King of Sweden. That was how the matter was left in about 1343, I think it was, when abdication was forced on Magnus. So it meant that decision meant that King Magnus was going to be out of power as far as Norway was concerned. And he had to wanted to do something about this. So that was his motive, his main motive for assigning Haakon to this expedition, because he wouldn't then have to deal with a rival king who was only 15 years old.
Right.
So it worked out very well. Haakon was empowered as king the year before the expedition set out. The expedition left in 1356, and Haakon had turned 15 the previous August. So the king, in effect, removed Haakon from from Norway, so the King Magnus had his say about how things were going to go for several years, and that's exactly how it worked out. And one question that will come up in your mind if you read the book, or as you maybe hear people talk about it, is how do we know that this expedition took place? And it's a lot of this information we deduce from the inscription on the Spirit Pond runestone.
Yes.
For example, we know that it was Haakon who was in the King's Proclamation of 1354. We know that the Spirit Pond inscription was made in 1362, or the winter of 1361-62, because there are two year numbers in that inscription, and the year numbers are the age of young King Haakon. They're not the year of his reign, because that would have been an insult to his father, who is kind of competing with Haakon, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't the year number, the year of the reign of his father, which is, would have been the customary way to express it, because that would have demeaned young King Haakon's position of power. So he chose his age, and actually that fits into the poem, the rhyming of the poem, quite well. But it also is it's such a great document, because now it tells us what the dates of these events were. Tells us when the expedition returned, when Haakon returned before he was married in 1363, he had to return to Norway to do that. So we know the inscription was of the Spirit Pond runestone was made in the 1361-62 winter. And to complete that story, if I don't get too far ahead of myself, is that is a memorial poem memorializing the loss of a ship and 17 men. 12 of those 17 were the king's own retinue, which he was empowered to name in the 1354 proclamation.
Mm.
It all fits together very well. The king's retinue and a crew of 5 men were lost when their ship sank on Hudson Bay. We know it sank on Hudson Bay because that's what the coordinates are, giving the distance to the west and the distance to the north from the location where the Spirit Pond runestone was found in Maine. So it all fits together very well, and it makes a wonderful story of a really documented history.
Yeah, that's right. They detail right on the stone how many, day journeys, as it's called, to westward and northward and everything, and you guys have pinned that down. It's pretty amazing. I wanted to ask you guys a little bit of how the Spirit Pond Runestone was found. And again, we're confronted with this idea that in the beginning when this happened, it was, you know, dismissed as just being, you know, gibberish on the stone and somebody had faked it or whatever, you know, despite there being the years and the correlations to the other stones and even the story historically, what was going on in Norway at that time. So how did they come across it?
That's a wonderful story, and it's told in the prologue of our book. It all began with a fellow by the name of Walter Elliott, who is a carpenter, just an ordinary guy in New England. But he was an avid arrowhead hunter and an Indian pot hunter. So he had his eye on this little lake called Spirit Pond on the coast of Maine. And at the outlet of this lake, where it goes off into a short river that flows into the ocean, thought he might find arrowheads. So he took his little rubber boat back in the 21st of May, I think it was, in 1971. Anyway, a warm day in May, they say. This is all recorded in a tape recording that's part of the record now. And he put his rubber boat in the water and paddled across to this outlet point where he thought he might find an Indian campground with arrowheads. And he started looking and didn't find anything. He sat down on a stone to smoke a cigarette and enjoy the pleasant day. And he said, I got up from sitting down on the rock and just kicked the grass, and there was this stone down there with all these markings on it. And that's how the Spirit Pond Runestone was found.
It was one of three stones also.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of sticking out of the mud.
Well, he had to dig for them, according to the account. One stone had a map of the area on it, which is a pretty good map for to be carved in a stone, you might say.
Yeah.
Another had a few odd ruins in it and some pictures of Indian people and some animals, I guess. But the main inscription stone was a kind of a flat stone with runes on both sides of it. Now, the interesting events that happened went like this. He knew he had something really unusual, and he tried to find somebody in academia, that is, in the Harvard University and other schools around there who would know runes and could tell him what the inscription said. No one would even pay any attention to him. And after a while, though, it got into the newspapers and people began to take a little more notice. And he even got an offer from, I think it was somebody in California who was a collector, for an offer of $10,000 to sell him if he would sell his stone to this guy. Well, he didn't do that because he was obsessed with trying to find out what the inscription said. Well, they actually, it ended up that the officials in the state of Maine told him that since you found that stone on state land, it belongs to the state of Maine and you have to give it up. He wasn't going to do that. So he took the stone and the other two, second and third stone that were found with it, took them all back to Spirit Pond and buried them a little far away from where they'd been found. And that really made complicated the dispute.
Yeah, he said, if state of Maine, if you want them, you go find them.
Right. Interesting.
So that eventually there were people who didn't want to lose the stones. And there was a local banker who acted as an ombudsman for Walter Elliott, who had discovered the stone. And he finally got an agreement that Walter would be paid about $3,000 to cover Walter's expenses in trying to find a translator for the stone. And then the stone would be given to the state of Maine, where I guess it legally should be. And that's what happened. It was given to the state of Maine, and is now curated in the Maine State Museum in Augusta. Well, the curator there asked Professor Einar Hogan of Harvard to take a look at the runes and translate them and tell him what the runes said. Well, Hogan did take a look at the inscription. It's a small stone, very crowded inscription, and as Janie has told you, I think, and can tell you again, when you have a crowded inscription, you do a lot of abbreviating.
Yeah.
Half of the words in runes on that stone are abbreviated in some way. Well, this wasn't what Einar Hogan, the professor from Harvard, expected. And he sort of gave up on the translation and said, well, it's got to be a hoax. He said it wasn't a hoax by Walter Elliott, because Walter Elliott would be incapable of providing this inscription and incapable of making the hoax. And everybody knew that Walter Elliott was an honest guy. So,
and Einar Hogan described it as a bunch of Norse words in a sea of gibberish.
Sea of gibberish, yeah, that's right.
So anyway, that's how the translation stood until Janie and I learned about it in about the year 2008, because that's when we...
2006. It was 2006.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
So when we decided we would write the book. And
well, at that point, let me put in here that Sue Carlson, who has been a longstanding member of the New England Antiquities Research Association, or NERA for short, she had taken a good hard try at trying to figure out the inscription of the Spirit Pond Stone in leading up to publication in two parts of their journal in 1991 and 92. She published there her best effort at it. And she did not recognize that these short lines over many of the words or parts of the words, that it meant that it was abbreviated. And it had Einar Hogan mentioned these, what we call overbars, but didn't really fully understand what they meant either. And so Sue Carlson didn't either. And so she did her best, but not, if you don't know what all those missing letters are representing and that the overbars even mean that they are abbreviated, you're only going to get so far with it. And as a serious calligrapher, and when I got a good close look at it, even though I was not well versed in runes at that point, I hadn't tried to start learning Old Norse yet.
Yep.
At that point, I could recognize that those overbars meant abbreviation. And I have shown photos of the Spirit Pond inscription stone to other serious calligraphers who do not read runes or Old Norse, and ask them, what do you think these lines are? And every one of them say, oh, that's abbreviation. That's obvious. It's something to a calligrapher or a paleographer, even though they may not recognize the rune letter form, they know that that means abbreviation.
Right.
This is as we would say, a no-duh.
The common technique to use utilize the space as much as possible, yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Why don't we end talking just about what the Spirit Pond Runestone actually say? And then we can take a little break and continue more on this, because there's obviously much more to the story. But what's actually on the stone? What does it say?
Well, we can read it if you like.
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. It's in the prologue of our book, and the translation that we have, which we are sure is rigorous and accurate, goes like this. It says, "Fallen kinsmen, ever valiant fellows, a roaring sea struck 17 dead. Hail to you, weeping fountains. Year 20, we lost the company of 12 companions, 12 dagrais westward, that is 900 miles to the west, 10 dagrais northward, 750 miles north." This is measured from Spirit Pond. "The saga of a young Folkung. Bearded chief man Hakan discovered a circle by being able to sail toward the west on the lakes of the Trade Empire. Weeping Fountains, year 21. A shout into the burning lights. Blessed Maria, alas! Tireless those on the seal ship to proceed to obtain an edge to devote attention in regard to win the ship against the terrible storm. 17 presage their inevitable battle stroke, except the sinking, the bane of their approaching death. Hail to you, weeping fountains, year 21. That's the eighth of young King Hakan when the poem was composed.
So it's a poem that they wrote here.
It was a poem, and one that was another handicap that Einar Hogan had, because he didn't know it was a poem. And there are certain poetic licenses, poetic license that you take to make the poem rhyme and have a good rhythm, and it just complicates the translation. And if you don't know that, and if you don't know the historical context, which is very important for some of the translation, then you don't do it. You don't get it.
You're not going to get it. That's right.
So our success in the translation was hinged a lot on uncovering the historical details of the story. Because some of the words, like
valiant warriors.
Yeah.
People had translated warriors as Odin, and not correct. One key phrase is Blessed Maria. It's Beata, and it is in Latin, and an abbreviated Latin phrasing. However, the Latin phrasing is Beata Maria, and that was a common phrasing used in honor of Holy Mary back in that time period. And to find that phrase in that form of abbreviation in an obscure, not to paleographers, but to most people, they would say it's an obscure dictionary of medieval Latin and Italian words, which I knew about. A very good paleographer acquaintance of mine that I knew that has since passed away referred me to this particular dictionary years back, and there it was in there.
Huh.
So it's not all strictly Old Norse. There is some Latin wording in it also, which complicates it further.
Well, exactly, and I guess that would make sense if these are, they come as Christians as well, but they're mixing it and blending it with the rune scripture of the time. There's no clear distinction between, one era versus the other, so to speak. There's an overlap of all these, different belief system and scriptures and everything, right?
Well, an interesting thing, back in the 1950s, at the medieval war of Bergen, Norway, or at that time called Bryggen, back in the 1950s, one of the warehouses burned down. And before it was going to be cleared away and rebuilt, archaeologists had a look at it, and they found so many wonderful, it was a gold mine of artifacts with rune writing on them. Many were wooden sticks or a small piece of wood with runes on them. Some of them were like, this is Bjorn's bale of wool, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Many were just labels, but some of them, and they weren't just wood, there were even two shoes with beautifully hand-stitched runic inscription going around the shoe that a woman must have done for her love of her life, her husband, boyfriend, whatever. And the quote is by Ovid, Greek philosopher Ovid, done in Latin in runes. And a number of other inscriptions were, for instance, the Pater Noster, or the Our Father,
Our Father,
and among other Latin religious phrasings.
Hmm.
Not all spelled the same way either. Sometimes the spelling was a little off, but using Latin written in runes was done at that time period, combined with Old Norse. And what was found at Bergen confirms that many, many, many times. So
yeah.
it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
It is. There's so much more to the story. We're going to continue to talk more about this and why the stone, the Spirit Pond rune stone, was buried in the place that it was. Could there be more of these lying around? It's almost to me like it's a breadcrumb, if you will, almost a hint that was, left there with intentions. But we'll talk more about that in the second segment, guys. And as we begin to wrap things up for the first one, I again want to give out the title, of course, of the book that we're talking about, The Last Kings of Norse America, Runestone Keys to a Lost Empire. And why don't we give out the website, guys, the URL, so people know where to go to read more about the book and pick up copies if they want to read more about this.
Okay, the website is pretty simple. It's www.thelastkingsofnorthamerica.com, with no spaces, no capitals or anything. So pretty straightforward.
Excellent. And people have links there, of course, to how to buy the book, and are they available,
yes,
primarily online, or are they in bookstores as well around in America and different parts in Europe? Do you guys know?
Let's see. Barnes & Noble has been carrying it in some stores. I don't know how far across the country, but we do have on the website a web address where you can get more information on ordering the book.
Very good. We'll have that linked up as well, of course, but the main website you guys need to remember is thelastkingsofnorthamerica.com, and we'll have that linked up from redicecreations.com.
Make sure it's N-O-R-S-E, Norse.
That's right, Norse. Yeah. We'll have the correct links up there. Okay, guys, thank you very much for this first segment. Stay with us. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll return with more after this. continue in the second hour with much more. This story is intricate and has many details to it, but as you listen, and as the different aspects fall into place, a very interesting story starts to emerge. We discuss the Newport Tower, the techniques on how to divide the property or land with hole stones, something that still can be seen in Iceland today. We'll talk about what ships they used to go over to North America, the writings on the Kensington Runestone with a different translation, and where it was found, how the area looked at the time that it was carved. We'll continue for another hour and a half in the member section with Robert and Janie. Please join us there to continue to listen. The website is redicemembers.com. It's only €5 per month, and we have 3-month recurring subscriptions and one-time payments going from 3 months up to 2 years, whatever works for you. You'll, of course, get access to our entire archives with tons of material on all kinds of fascinating topics that we are certain will spark debate and enrich the quest towards attaining answers and the ability to ask more pertinent questions about life, reality, and our past. We'll talk to you on the other side of this break. Thank you, guys.